Thank you, sir. As a person melancholy on principle, but congenitally sanguine, I propose to let some cheerfulness break in. I think that the prospects before us are by no means wholly discouraging, that we have gained some ground and will gain a good deal more, in part because we are aided by circumstance. Now, I'm contrasting here the position of the conservatively inclined scholar as contrasted with the ideologue, the political fanatic. Of course, I don't mean by ideology, political philosophy or theory or principle. I mean political fanaticism. That is, the ideologue is a man who has an inverted religion, who, in Vogelin's phrase, makes immanent the symbols of transcendence, and who promises the earthly paradise, ordinarily through the operation, at the very least, of radical change in positive law, and commonly through revolution. And ideology has, of course, been a great curse of our age, which has been called, indeed, the age of ideology. I think, nevertheless, that we are escaping from that clutch, and that right reason, or perhaps, as our ancestors said, practical reason, will once more have a hearing. In short, I am associating here generally conservative principles with practical reason. Mr. Kimpton, when he was Chancellor of the University of Chicago, once remarked, I don't call it conservatism, I call it common sense. And there's a good deal in that. In short, the conservative is a person ordinarily who proceeds according to the dictates of practical reason, who is not a fanatic, who is guided in large part by the historical experience of the species, and who looks forward to the practical consequences of every proposal. And I think that kind of mentality is going to have more and more of a hearing in this country. I am contrasting, in short, conservative ideas with what Burke called metaphysical madness. Now, we have one natural advantage in this country, that the American people, and for that matter, in that matter, they are very like the British people, have always been non-ideological. This has been, in some ways for us, a kind of handicap in recent years, because it means that also the American people, like the British, are suspicious of theory. They go almost totally for practice, constitution, institution, and they dislike any kind of abstract discussion. Nevertheless, this is also, for the most part, an advantage for us, since the American people always tend to recoil from fanatic proposals, radical change, and the doctrinaire. Thus, no real ideologue has ever been able to gain power nationally in America, and while they may do mischief from time to time, the public in the long run, and ordinarily in the short run, will reject the really radical reformer. So ideology never had a real clutch here, and such clutch as it had is diminishing. It is communism, which, after all, never attracted more than, say, about 5% of the college faculties, for instance, is now the god that failed. You will not find that a serious intellectual power. The communist movement can still do mischief in various ways, but one doesn't have to contest with it on the intellectual realm in America, as one would still have to contest with it in so much of even Western Europe or Latin America or modern Asia and Africa. It's not a question of refuting communist doctrines. The public is in no danger of consciously embracing communist doctrines. In that sense, we are not contending against a formidable, rigorous ideology. We contend against something rather different, and rather easier to overcome, that is the vague liberal mentality or attitude, which, however, itself is ceasing to have any ideological roots and has become more nearly a kind of nihilism. Not like the old Russian nihilism, which was in itself an ideological and fanatic movement, but simply a rejection of any of all those things which they call value judgments. And a man who, after all, rejects all value judgments is insecure, he's nervous, and he is not going to put up much of a fight intellectually or in any way if he is confronted with any very serious and coherent opposition. Let me give you an example of the attitude which may suggest the general drift of modern liberalism, I think, in this country. I am fond of going around the country talking about the recovery of norms, and I often tell this story, which some of you here may have heard before, a true anecdote of my own college days. They used to come around to Michigan State College when I was an undergraduate, a gentleman whom we'll call Mr. Stewart, who used to sell textbooks, but spent most of his time arguing with the relativists on the campus about the need for some first principles. And he had his work cut out for him then, as he would now. I was once present at a discourse he had with a professor of English, I believe, in a coffee house. And we can call the professor Dr. Nemo, who was a well-meaning man, who, however, saw no enemies to the left and believed that progress was naturally leading us toward a kind of earthly paradise, and progress could be interrupted only by the folly of a few reactionaries, but they too would be swept away soon by the wave of the future. Well, Mr. Stewart began as follows. Now, after all, Dr. Nemo, I'm sure there are some first principles upon which well-inclined persons like yourself and myself can agree. For instance, would you agree that 2 and 2 are 4? Now, let me see, said Dr. Nemo, do 2 and 2 make 4? I didn't say make 4, said Mr. Stewart. I said are 4. Well, said Dr. Nemo, you know mathematics is not my field, and I don't feel that we really ought to examine topics which are in our own disciplines, but after all, I understand that there are now non-Euclidean systems coming into vogue, and all these things are being reevaluated and discussed, and I don't see how you and I have a right to make a personal value judgment that 2 and 2 are 4. Well then, said Mr. Stewart, let's transfer this to the humane scale. Would you say, for instance, Dr. Nemo, that Jesus was a better person than Nero? Now, after all, said Dr. Nemo, let's not be intolerant. These two people lived in a different social milieu. After all, there's a great deal we don't know about Nero's childhood. I don't see how you and I have a right to make a value judgment on a question like that. Well then, said Mr. Stewart, let's bring this down to modern times, Dr. Nemo. Would you say, for instance, what should you say was a better man? This was before the Second World War, a little before it. What should you say was a better man, Hitler or Stalin? Well, after all, said Dr. Nemo, let's not reduce this to absurdity. Of course Stalin's a better man. Dr. Nemo did have some value judgments and some preferences, even though they're founded wholly upon prejudice and misinformation. My point, of course, is not to discuss the relative degrees of iniquity of Stalin and Hitler, but to suggest that a man can be very gravely mistaken if he tries to operate without value judgments and nevertheless is necessarily forced in this life to make them. And very bad consequences can come to the person and the republic if one operates, in short, without any first principles. Now, as I say, I go around telling this story, and I remark here and there, well, things are somewhat better now. Dr. Nemo probably has changed his opinion, as a result of the terrible troubles of our time, surely most people realize there's some need, especially in politics, for having some sort of first principles. But I told this story fairly recently at a discussion before the Ethical Cultural Society of New York with a sociologist from New York University. And after I told it, he said quite humorously and gravely, well, I can't agree with Mr. Kirk there. After all, take Jesus and Nero. Now, they had one had one social station and one had another, and they had different personal experiences. I don't see how we can say that one was better than the other. They had different value preference systems, that's all. Which I replied, yes, they did indeed have different value preferences. Jesus, if you call it a preference, preferred to die on the cross for the salvation of mankind, while Nero preferred to commit incest with his mother and then murder her. They are indeed different value systems, but is not one preferable to the other? Well, that's the kind of nihilism I'm speaking of, and of course it is obviously intellectually absurd, And obviously the man who holds it is in a very confused state. Our friend, Dr. Eric Van Kuno, the dean, says the typical modern American liberal is nervous, trembling at every shadow, insecure because he no longer has any body of belief, and he is virulent in proportion as he is nervous, and starts frightened at any threat to his precarious domination of the intellectual world. In that sense, obviously, there is considerable hope for the spread of conservative ideas, since the opposition, despite its seeming dominance, is a very weak regime and has no confidence, really, in its own survival. And as I say, its virulence is proportionate to this feebleness. Virulence is not ordinarily a sign of strength. A very strong regime will not be virulent, quite tolerant ordinarily, because it has no fear of being overthrown. And with this on our side, and I think the considerable restoration of the respectability of conservative ideas in recent years, after all, there is some reason to allow cheerfulness to break in. I add here some suggestions that, indeed, recent events suggest to us that, after all, practical reasons, claims must necessarily be considered once more, even by those who call themselves liberals. I find that a great many liberals now feel a certain unease at the condition of the world, and indeed at its general drift. I find that particularly if one takes up with them the discussion of the decay of diversity and variety, the prospect of a universal mediocrity as a result of certain modern tendencies, one can find some fellow feeling and is unable to carry on a rational discussion. And aside from that, obviously the terrible events of recent years must have their effect in a practical as well as an intellectual way. Thus, on a practical level, conservative principles and policies in the conduct of foreign relations necessarily once more have a hearing, even if confusedly at first, because obviously the liberal illusions, the kind of mentality 50 years old, which was alluded to earlier in connection with Mr. Adlai Stevenson and others, or is more conspicuous still, let us say, Mr. Chester Bowles, that is now so thoroughly discredited that one necessarily turns to, at least however confusedly and reluctantly, to some of the conservative maxims for the conduct of foreign policy. And thus we are rather confusedly and imperfectly reverse our policy in the Congo. Not that we have formed a good policy, but at least we have abandoned the liberal ideologues' policy there in large part. Or similarly, we are forced to become trigger-happy in Vietnam because there is no alternative. Not again that a coherent policy has been formed there, but at least the former policy of slogan and drift, has necessarily in part been abandoned. Similarly, in domestic circumstances, one is forced once more to consider the possibility of conservative economic policy, for instance. The precarious state of the dollar necessarily will impel any administration to begin to think about alternatives to its previous policy, and what those alternatives are necessarily is comparatively conservative measures. Again, this is only prospering perhaps by adversity, and great disasters may ensue in various realms of action before the public and indeed the intellectual leaders begin to really take thought. And nevertheless, there is this grim possibility that one will recover right reason or practical reason as a result of adversity, and let us hope, before those disasters are catastrophic. There's also reason for hope in this, that, as Disraeli said, prevailing opinions generally are the opinions of the generation that is passing. As has been remarked earlier, the opinions of which we are governed in the liberal realm of thought and propaganda today are the opinions really of half a century ago. They are already beginning to seem archaic. And the people who enunciate those ideas, particularly on the more or less popular level, are men of the generation that is passing. I reflect sometimes, say that the influential and comparatively serious newspaper columnists, as well as some who are simply scandal mongers, all the way, let us say, from Mr. Walter Lippmann to Mr. Drew Pearson, are people that I was reading when I was in the seventh grade. These are indeed the Mayans of yesterday. They are now in the Sir and Yellow Leaf, and things are changing here. Similarly, in the university, although we obviously have enormous ground to make up, one does see the beginnings of a serious revolt among the younger scholars, despite the continued domination, of course, of the graduate schools by a kind of relativism or nihilism, which is not quite ideology, but has a certain hankering after ideology. I think here, incidentally, most of the harm occurs in the graduate schools rather than at the undergraduate level. And in a sense, it makes our work somewhat easier, since if we would concentrate primarily, with our limited resources, upon the graduate school level. I say that not so much harm is done at the undergraduate level, because most American undergraduates don't think at all while they're in college, and are therefore immune to ideology, to nihilism, or anything else. I'm reminded of a test we used to give at Michigan State College when I was in the faculty there. It was to determine the work of the college in eradicating prejudice. The test was given to all entering freshmen and given to all graduating seniors. Hundreds of questions. The assumption of the authors of the test was the whole function of the college was to get rid of these ancient prejudices one had gotten from one's family and church and so on, and to provide the student with an open or vacuum mind, in which any wind of doctrine might enter. A very interesting test, and I'll just name two questions. One was, do you believe that if you want a thing done well, you must do it yourself? If you answered yes, of course you were wrong. It obviously should be done by committee. Faculty committee is the efficient way to do things. Another question was, do you believe it is wrong for brother and sister to have sexual relations? Now, if you answered no, you might be positively wrong. This is a thing you ought to keep open-minded about, to discuss, willing to consider. You shouldn't be dogmatic about matters like this. Well, they gave this test to all entering freshmen and to all graduating seniors in the 4 years. And to the hideous chagrin of my colleagues in the faculty, it was found the students hadn't changed their opinions at all. They had the college's work had totally failed. In that sense, the low level, perhaps, of intellectuality in the American college has been a safeguard. I'm very cheerful about that, but that does, at any rate, gives us reason for concentrating perhaps more in the graduate school than the undergraduate school. In short, I don't think that we need despair, or that our defeat of conservatives in the recent election has anything to do with the popularity or unpopularity of conservative ideas so far as the public grasps them as yet. In fact, I suppose the primary reason for Senator Goldwater's defeat, and I ratify this in my observation of my own county, my own township, which we succeeded in losing for the first time in the history of the Republican Party, was that the very conservative population among whom I live thought of Senator Goldwater as a radical, as an irresponsible radical who was going to change things terribly and might cause all kinds of trouble for everybody. It was a complete misunderstanding as a result of the liberal propaganda, but that's what occurred. And it was indeed this result was forecast to me by, speaking of polls, by a Chicago pollster, Mr. Louis Cheskin, a few weeks before the election. Mr. Cheskin conducts polls at an effort to ascertain the underlying prejudices of the voter rather than how the voter thinks he will vote, and thus forecast how the voter will vote even though the voter himself does not yet know. He gives a long series of elaborate questions to ascertain the underlying prejudices. He said his key question as to the poll for the presidency had to do with deer hunting. He had three questions on deer hunting, of which I'll mention the first, which was as follows. Suppose that Mr. Johnson and Mr. Goldwater were out on a deer hunting expedition. Do you think that either of these gentlemen would be likely to fire at the first movement in the brush? Of the public polled, 17% said that President Johnson would fire at the first movement in the brush. About 37% said that Senator Goldwater would fire at the first movement in the brush. Therefore, Mr. Cheskin, it's all over. The prejudice against Senator Goldwater on that score is very deeply rooted and cannot be compensated for by a prejudice in his favor on any other score. And indeed, so it turned out. In short, the election had nothing whatsoever to do with the question of conservative power.